is that a dirge? Is that, I don't know, what is that? It just seems like some sort of very sad music. I was all in a good mood. Now I'm bummed out. Well, good morning. Welcome, everybody. It's Wednesday. That's what day it is. It's Wednesday. It's the 24th of June. Very nice to have you all with us on the broadcast. 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. Let me introduce the group to you. Before I do that, just remember you're part of this group, and you're more than welcome to participate. All you have to do in emailing us is send your note to panel@wamc.org. Keep them short. Keep them to the point. Pre-read them, that's all we ask, and stay on topic, and we'll be good to go. panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce everybody to you, and we will begin. WAMC's Alan Chartok, good morning, sir. How are you this fine rainy morning?
Good morning, sir. Back to you. I walked in the thunderstorm today. I walked my 4 miles.
Oh, you didn't get struck by lightning, did you?
No, I took my keys off from around my neck, which I always wear. I thought that wasn't a great idea.
You didn't fly the kite with the key at the end?
No, I was thinking of Ben Franklin, and I said, no, that wouldn't be the right thing to do. But I got home, got a little rain, but it was really a nice walk. So
yeah,
it was a nice day.
Nice summer rain.
I'm here and I'm present, Joe.
Excellent. And accounted for. And it's good to hear your voice. We also welcome to the broadcast someone that we don't normally hear of on a Wednesday morning on here, but I'm more than thrilled to have Libby Post, political consultant, lobbyist. She was up late last night working on returns and for all the campaigns, and will tell us sort of a rundown as she watches this stuff all very closely. And it's great to have Libby with us this morning. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
Good, Joe. I'm very thrilled to be here, and I'm awake.
Excellent. That's all, that's pretty much all we ask of our panelists. Just be awake.
Right, I know.
Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness. He's always awake. Homeland Security at the University at Albany. Bob Griffin. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Joe. And I agree with you. I'm a little bit disappointed in Mike Bowen's choice of music this morning.
I don't know that it was his choice. Wait, hold on.
Okay.
See, we have a group that does this, so I don't know. I don't think we can. Mike is saying no, he didn't. But I don't want to out anyone else. It's lovely music. It just wasn't what I was expecting.
I want to register and say I love the music.
Yeah,
it's right to my soul, my very being.
Okay, yeah. Well, enjoy it then.
And as far as being awake, Joe, yes, and I also have the T-shirt that says I'm an emergency manager. If you see me running, try to keep up.
Sarah LeDuc takes full credit for the music. She said, I chose it. It's from Lou Harrison, is the composer, an iconic gay composer, and we are playing that music this morning. So there we go. And
I can't say anything bad about Sarah, though, so I retract that comment.
Isn't that nice, Mike? He'll take you to the equators, but not Sarah. And finally, last but certainly not least, we welcome Sienna Freeman Tolbert to the program. She is an immigration attorney and associate with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Good morning, Sienna. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Joe. Good morning.
It's great to have you here. Thank you very much for
being with us.
All right, let's get started and talk about the news of the day. And I assume the news of the day is the primary news and what we know from yesterday's primaries. Insurgents are taking on the establishment-backed candidates in several races in New York and Kentucky. In a lot of cases, we still don't know the results. It's been getting the numbers in, given that so many are absentee, has been difficult. So we're going to talk a little bit about those numbers and what we make of those. We should also mention that for the first time this election season, with our dear friends at Siena College, the New York Times has released their first poll of the 2020 presidential race, which has Joe Biden at 50% and the president at 36%. That in the first New York Times Upshot Siena College poll of registered voters. So we'll want to weigh in and talk about that as well. Actually, any thoughts on that right off the bat, Alan?
Yes, that's good, but not good enough. What is it?
What exactly do you want?
What is it? 14%?
Yeah, 14%.
50% lead. Yeah, something like that. I mean, this guy is such a disgrace and is so bad, Trump, You would think that even with the reactionary element and the people that he caters to, 14% seems pretty good right now. But remember, he's going to try to rig this. He's already yelling the others are rigging it, which means he's going to rig it. He's going to try to rig it. You know, he doesn't want mail-in ballots. He doesn't want to make it easy to vote. He's going to try to rig it, and I hope 14% is enough.
So let us talk about the – anybody else on the poll, actually, before we move on? Libby, anything on that?
Well, I think Alan's right. He's going to try to he's going to just try to, you know, make the election seem like it's been rigged. But with the armed forces, with the military pushing back against him, the idea that he's never going to leave the White House if he's not elected, you're not reelected, is laughable. I think the ushers will make sure his stuff is packed. Probably on November 5th. It's a heartening poll. It's a heartening poll. I think, you know, we need to be vigilant. It's national. We still need to watch the swing states. I'm not taking anything for granted.
Well, you're right. And let's remember how he got elected the last time. He didn't win the popular vote.
Right.
I mean, we can't say enough times. We can't say it enough times. So he's going to be concentrating on those states where he thinks he has a shot. And that's where, if there's going to be rigging, that's where it's going to happen.
Meanwhile, Bob, did you want to say anything on that?
No, just a quick comment, though. I mean, it's clear that the president is watching the polls, because every time a new poll comes out, he comes out with another extreme position. You noticed yesterday his position on trying to resurrect the non-issue of flag burning. And, you know, he's bringing back some of his pet red meat to base issues. So it's going to be an interesting run.
Meanwhile, two African-American candidates seized the momentum in recent weeks as the nation grappled with the question of racial justice and earned a groundswell of support in Democratic primaries on Tuesday, one in Kentucky, the other in New York, that could propel them to upset victories. Charles Booker, a state legislator, was locked in a close race with retired Marine Corps fighter pilot Amy McGrath, a top recruit of National Democrats, for the chance to wage a long-shot bid against Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Meanwhile, okay, the races are off. Let's stop that. Okay. And Alan, if you want to know who was calling, it was my mother-in-law. Yeah.
Wow.
And like normal, I didn't take the call.
Oh, brother. Are you in trouble?
You're in so much trouble now.
So you got the Kentucky race, and then we go to New York, where Jamal Bowman, a former middle school principal, took an early lead against longtime Representative Elliot Engel, the Democrat, and the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, who was elected to the House in 1988, and both Booker and Bowman ran to the left of their more moderate opponents and have been embraced by the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, including securing endorsements from Bernie Sanders and AOC, which we were talking about yesterday, that up until yesterday, those endorsements had not yielded wins. But in this case, in these two primaries, they were very, seemed to be, anyway, quite successful. Alan, let's begin with you.
Well, first of all, let's remember, I hope Libby will agree with me about this, but maybe not. I think that these wins, I said it yesterday, I'm going to say it again today, are determined by a changing demographic in the district. And that is exactly what has happened in Engel's district, no question.
Absolutely.
When I worked for a congressman, he always knew it, and he would say it all the time. So I think that is the number one reason why you're seeing the Engel candidacy go down. People don't give a damn about the chairmanship of the Foreign Relations Committee. They say, "Is this guy like me?" So Engel, we expected it. Engel loses, I suspect. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, Libby.
Yeah, I said it the other day. You know, in that district, it's, you know, Mount Vernon, it's poor, it's northern Bronx, it's not, you know, these people are more concerned with putting food on the table than they are with Elliot Engel being the head of the Foreign Relations Committee, because it's so far removed from them. The only time the Foreign Relations Committee really counts for something is when we're in a war, and then people start paying attention to it and the policies that it's going to promulgate. But, you know, the thing is this, when you look at these results, I mean, according to the Times, Amy McGrath won in Kentucky against Charles Booker. So you have a more moderate Democratic base in Kentucky, clearly, that was not going to be, you know, impacted as much by Bernie Sanders and the left. But then you move to New York, where it's a totally different demographic and base. And you've got people like Carolyn Maloney hanging on, right, by the skin of her teeth, 41-40. You've got, you know, AOC won, but Richie Torres won the Democratic primary, so it seems, for the 15th to replace Serrano. And he was running against Michael Blake, a former assemblyman, and Ruben Diaz, who is as far to the right as you can get, but considers himself a Democrat. And thankfully, Diaz only got 14.7% of the vote. So it's really interesting to watch this. And Mondaire Jones, who was the most progressive in the 17th, which is Nita Lowey's district, ran away with it with 44.8% of the vote.
Okay,
so
Professor.
You need to look at the states we're in.
Okay, Professor. While you're at it. Let's go to Carolyn Maloney. Carolyn Maloney. I know her very well. She used to work for me. She was my assistant once, a long time ago.
Long time ago.
It was a really long time ago, and I know her quite well. And she's as tough as nails. But the east side of Manhattan, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on what's going on there. You think that the east side of Manhattan and some of the other outliers that she has in her district, I think Queens, was some Queens district. What is making the challenge here more interesting or more compelling?
Well, the east side of Manhattan has always been Republican or leaning that way, as we know. I mean, that's where Roy Goodman came out of, and you know, some of the last vestiges of the Rockefeller Republicans. And so Maloney might not be seen as progressive enough for the progressives that are in that district. And, you know, the demographics in New York are changing, and even the Upper West East Side is changing. And so you have a new person, you know, challenging Maloney. I think she'll probably pull it out. But again, it's going to be up to the absentees. This is very, very close. It's like 500 and change votes. So it's all going to come down to the absentees.
All right. Sienna, what do you make of all of this?
I'm not an expert like Libby. She's impressive.
Libby is impressive.
What you think.
But I can just say in general that I believe that all of this has to do more of this activity in the at the polls and the changes. It has to do with COVID and people being home and people being able to be more informed about what's going on rather than worrying about, you know, primarily about their 9-to-5. Now they're home, they're able to, you know, educate themselves more and inform themselves more. And so I'm excited about that opportunity for people to get involved.
I don't think I, with some temerity, I don't agree. I think, in fact, it is the number one issue is the candidate more like me or more like somebody else? And when the demographics change the way they have in some of these districts, I think it's all over for Elliot Engel and other people like him. It's not because people are sitting home considering their votes. It's because they feel closer and can identify, I think, with the, you know, Co-op City in Engel's district used to be pretty Jewish. It ain't anymore. And you can just see where that demographic change happens.
You know, and Sienna, go ahead, Libby.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I think it's a combination of both. I think Sienna has some very good points. I think people are sitting home more, especially in the last few months, and are looking at things a little more, not critically, but what else are they going to do? You know, it's like many people have just been home, And so this all of this is happening around them. They're watching the governor, or they were watching the governor every day, and he was talking about absentee voting, and he was talking about the importance of doing that. And so I think, you know, because of that, you know, we do see an upswing in the amount of absentee ballots. But you couple that with the demographic changes.
What's the rule of thumb?
The demography is changing.
Libby, what's the rule of thumb on absentee ballots? In other words, okay, so now everybody's saying, well, you know, Soares is ahead, what, by 8 or 9 points, something like that.
David Soares, district attorney of County of Albany.
Right.
And everybody says, yeah, but, you know, with the absentee ballots out there, nothing is right. But there used to be some... I'm sorry, just let me finish this one little idea.
We have a minute. Go ahead.
Then I won't consider it. The question for Libby is, how can we sort of, can we make any assumptions about the absentee ballots?
What's the rule of thumb, Libby?
The rule of thumb was that the absentee ballots will reflect the machines, but there's no reason to think that what happens at the machines is going to be any different in the absentee ballots. And I think in some races, like John McDonald's race, which I did work on, the 108th AD will bear that out. But that's 4,900 ballots in a smaller size race compared to all of Albany County, where there's a lot. There's thousands of absentee ballots out. And I think that there is... This isn't going to be over until the last ballot is opened, and you know it's going to be a nail biter. But the rule is this: for every one absentee vote that the leader gets, whoever that leader is, the trailer has to get two to balance it out. So that's going to be more difficult.
All right, we're going to take a break.
Going into these camps.
When we come back, we will continue. We have much more to discuss. Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Bob Griffin, and Libby Post on the panel this morning. We welcome your letters, as always. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Bob Griffin, and Libby Post all on the panel this morning, and we welcome you. All right. We have a letter. We have some letters. Let me read those, and then we'll move on to some other subjects. Dolores says, I live on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. Although I voted for Carolyn Maloney, I was applauded by her... I was appalled by her print and TV ads implying that her opponent was a pedophile. I think had I not filed an absentee ballot, I might have changed my vote to Patel in protest. That was Suraj Patel, who is running against Carolyn Maloney.
As I say, I know her very well, and she is one tough lady. It's not a good idea to fool with her because she gets very angry.
Eric,
and that's what happened here.
Yeah. And when things get close, you go negative, and that can work and it cannot work.
Mm-hmm.
Eric writes, the primaries are a joke, especially in states like New York, where independents, usually the moderates, have no way to participate. I dislike both political parties, so my voice isn't heard in the primaries, and it makes the elections more extreme. To fix the broken system, all voices must be allowed to participate in the primaries. That from Eric.
Well, I certainly agree with that, and we have that here in my very good state of Massachusetts, where if you're on an unenrolled voter, you go in, they say you want a Democratic or a Republican primary ballot. I think it's a great idea, and I think the point is extremely well taken.
A great idea,
Joe,
though. Go ahead, Bob.
If I could also jump in.
Absolutely.
You know, one point that I think is important is that it's still showing a huge—this primary shows a huge amount of voter frustration and voters are clearly looking for something different. And it's not just the election in New York and Kentucky. There was also that kind of strange vote in North Carolina in the Republican primary. But I think this is going to continue on throughout the summer and is going to play a big role in November's vote, this sense of voter frustration. Back to the letter, I do agree with the letter writer that both parties seem to be pulling further away from the center. And I'm not sure what that means, because at some point in time, there's going to be an awful lot of voters that are sitting sort of more in the moderate middle that somebody is going to be able to collect.
Can I talk about the moderate part of this a little bit there, Joe? And that is that, you know, to me, Mitch McConnell is the second most dangerous person in the country.
Yeah.
I would love to see Mitch McConnell go bye-bye. I don't mean death. I mean just in terms of losing. So I want to make that clear.
Whichever
you know, and I think McGrath has the best chance of doing that because she's more moderate in a moderate state. Mm-hmm. Now, there are an awful lot of people who don't like what I'm saying. They say, oh, no, you know, I'm a liberal Democrat and I want somebody in there who really will carry the flag. But in fact, is more likely to lose to McConnell. That's why I think the vote is spoken in Kentucky.
Absolutely.
We have a letter on that just that I want to go to real quick, which is Libby made a point that McGrath is way ahead in the Democratic Kentucky Senate race. However, it's important to note that Louisville, per the New York Times, has not released results. Before we claim that McGrath won by a significant amount, we need to wait until Tuesday. Is that next Tuesday when the results are released? It's still possible that Booker will eke out a win, considering that Louisville is significantly more diverse than the rest of the state.
All true.
All right. Mike says they're expecting 1.1 million votes in the Kentucky primary. A typical vote tally for a primary there is 600,000. It's very hard for me to believe that 500,000 plus people that voted are anything but Democrats or people that want to remove Trump. This, in my mind, is exceptional news. We also go to Michael and says, are you serious? The demographics of Elliott Engel's district didn't just change over the past 2 years. His constituents were provided with an alternative candidate who had made more appealing policies. People don't just support candidates who look like them. They support candidates who share their values.
To me, I say the same thing. They share their values. They look like them. And in fact, a guy wrote me this week and said, you should have more science in political science. And I think we do know that people tend to vote for people who are more like them. So that while that's prescriptive, you're just, how do you say this, wrong?
Timothy writes, I'm going to throw this one to you, Libby. Timothy writes and says, I requested and did not receive a mail-in ballot for the primary. Ooh. Better not happen in November. What advice do you have for Timothy and people like him?
Well, I heard that I had a friend, an old friend from who lives in Brooklyn, who texted me yesterday. I applied for my ballot weeks ago. I haven't gotten it yet. What should I do? And I said, put on your big girl mask and your big girl pants and go vote in at your, you know, polling place. And then she texted me later in the day, oh, I got it in the mail today, which is too late. So what needs to happen here is that the boards of elections across the state and across the country need to plan a little bit better. Now, I know that things got sort of hoisted on them. First, we were going to have the presidential primary and then not, and then it was back on again. But now they've got, you know, until mid-October or whatever it's going to be, whenever the deadline is to get them out, to get it done. And so the printing needs to be done now or once after next week, once everything is finalized. The printing needs to be done and the fulfillment needs to get done in a way that everybody who wants to vote absentee will be able to.
Libby, do you think there's any chance, because somebody will write us a letter about this, that some of these boards of elections are playing it fast and loose?
Conjecture, sure. Fact, who knows? I don't have any facts. But I think, you know, there are probably some that have. I think, you know, this was happening in New York. I know I do know for a fact that, you know, the New York ballots were, some of which were being mailed out locally, you know, were not, in terms of fulfillment, weren't getting to where they needed to go in a timely manner. And I don't know if that's the board's playing fast and loose or just not being prepared.
Mm. Yeah, and Alan, don't forget next time that, nothing looks like conspiracy quite like incompetence.
Absolutely,
you're
right.
certainly that's, right about that.
I would say that line. I'm going to use it.
2-1, probably, that you're right about that. Hey, Joe, Carolita from Kingston wrote us a note. Said voters are faking. If anyone could vote in any primary, what theoretically is to stop them from doing what the teenagers and K-pop crowd did to Trump's rally? Couldn't they vote for a candidate on the opposite side so they think they will lose to their ultimate favored candidate? And that's from Carolita in Kingston. And Carolita has a very good point. How do I know? Because I've done it.
What do you mean?
In other words, I voted for the weaker, for the Republican in a primary who I thought would have the least chance of winning.
Well, and this was a great concern during the primaries, right? That a lot of people were going in, that the Republicans that were allowed to, as you were saying, in states that were allowed to vote in open primaries to vote for Bernie and other candidates that would upset the apple cart, as it were.
Someday when we have about 11 hours more, we can talk a little bit about the whole concept of primaries and how they're good and how they're bad.
That'll be our special series on primaries. All right, let's move on to some other topics while we have a few moments before the break. We go to the story where Dr. Anthony Fauci, remember him?
He was on NPR this morning.
Yes. He was at Congress yesterday, and he told Congress on Tuesday that he was seeing a disturbing surge of infections in some parts of the country as Americans ignore social distancing guidelines and states reopen without adequate plans for testing and tracing the contacts of those who get sick. Dr. Fauci's assessment, delivered during a lengthy hearing before the House Energy and Commerce Committee, painted a much grimmer picture of the coronavirus threat than the one given by President Trump, who claimed last week that the virus that had infected more than 2 million Americans and killed more than 121,000 people would just fade away, his words. Dr. Fauci said the virus is not going to disappear. The nation's top infectious disease expert, who testified that the virus was not yet under control in the United States. His testimony came as more than half of the country was seeing an uptick in cases, with officials in some states slowing their return to work plans or even imposing new restrictions. Bob?
Yeah, this is really disturbing. And we're seeing, I'm watching the numbers pretty carefully, and we're seeing marked increases in a number of states, including places like California and Texas and Florida, Arkansas, both North and South Carolina. Joe, what all of the good work that is being done in places like New York and all the sacrifices that were made in order to try to reduce the spread of this pandemic are pretty much being undone right now because of the politics of the current administration and the positions of a lot of governors. And I am really worried, but I'm also looking at the global numbers, and I don't want people to sleep on that either, particularly what's going on in places like India, where the numbers are really skyrocketing. I think Fauci was really correct in one point that I don't want to scare people, but I don't think this is a second wave. I think this is still a continuation of this first wave, and that there is a second wave coming, particularly as we start to get into the combination of a flu season with the COVID season. So I'm very pessimistic, and right now I'm actually in Chicago for a family matter.
I am shocked.
I'm shocked at the number of people that are not doing anything, Alan. There are people all over the place that are not obeying social distancing. They're not wearing masks. They're acting as if they ignore it, it'll go away.
Now, what about the Trumpers, Bob? Somebody like the governor of Texas, who has been slavish in his adherence to Trump and his nonsense. All of a sudden, he's saying, maybe you better stay home. I'm not going to make it mandatory, but maybe you better stay home. What do you think that's about?
I think it's a realization that that his political life is in jeopardy, because what he's done is the root cause of a lot of the spread, and he's going to try to be able to spin it to say that it was about personal responsibility, and therefore it wasn't the failure of the state or federal government. It's cowardly. It's absolutely cowardly. And you're right, Alan. He took a very interesting position, didn't he? That urging people to stay home, but I'm not going to force you to do it. And it's like, come on, guy. Either lead from the front or get out of the way.
And they're seeing really disturbing numbers and hospitalizations at record rates. And I mean, it is very concerning when you look at Texas. The enormity of the state, but also of how it is spreading across the state is very concerning. Sienna, anything on that?
Sure. Yeah, I think it was encouraging to see Fauci again. I think we need more of Dr. Fauci coming out and speaking to us. Over the last few weeks, it's been pretty confusing because we're hearing about reopening. And I think on the news, you're seeing people at beaches and certain places and interacting. And I think it's important that we have the facts that go along with it. I was just recently reading a Johns Hopkins study where they're saying that the U.S. is 4% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's COVID cases and 25% of the world's COVID deaths. I mean, we need more of that information to be coming out. I think there's a lot of misinformation from the top. And I think we need, I was in Ohio, similar to Bob, he's in Chicago, I was in Ohio, and almost we were the only ones with masks on. Mm-hmm. And I was very shocked. There was a couple of people with masks on versus here in New York where everyone has a mask on, and being without a mask is rare. So it's just, you see, I think it's because of that misinformation. And I think it's because the administration rolled back on Fauci speaking to us every day like Cuomo did. We still need him out there. We still need our scientists and our doctors out there informing us about what's going on.
The idea that the EU may ban travel from the U.S. as it reopens borders, citing the coronavirus failures of this country, I mean, that speaks volumes, doesn't it, Bob?
It does. It does. But let's remember that it isn't only that they want to close the borders. But why? Because we haven't done our jobs in this country.
Right.
And by the way, they have, Joe. Their numbers, and we quoted India before, cited India as being really pathetic at this whole thing, but the EU countries have done extremely well, and they don't want us to infect them. I can't blame them.
So when did we become a third world country, Bob?
Let's see. So I think that would be January 20th, 2017. If I needed to put a date on it. You know, it's interesting, and for people who are offended by the position from the EU, I asked them to also take a look at our own immigration policies and our own position as our international partners and neighbors. I'm kind of waiting for the folks up in Canada to get wise and start to push for a wall. You know, to try to keep us out. So you start to see some of these issues really, really come together. And frankly, I mean, Trump's been sticking it in people's eyes for the past 4 years. And, you know, this is karma. This is coming back to bite.
All right. We're going to take a break. Yeah, go ahead, Sienna.
I was going to note that the new proclamation came out about immigration where Trump was saying based on COVID, he's cutting off all immigrant visas. He's expanding the suspension for people to come over to the U.S. on immigrant visas until December 31st, 2020, just based on COVID unemployment rates, but also based on health. And I think that's pretty funny considering, you know, his stance on reopening and his lack of encouraging public health matters in this country.
And symbolic, keep those people out.
Right.
That's going to help me win.
Exactly.
Including the spouses and family members of Americans too. I mean, this isn't just about immigration. This is separating families, and it's a policy continuation of caging children at the border.
That's right.
Exactly.
It's just more cruelty. All it is more cruelty, and that's what this administration is based on.
We are very late for break, so let's take it. And when we come back, we will continue our lively conversation. Alan Chartok, Sienna Friedman-Tolbert, Bob Griffin, and Libby Post. We'll do so right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable panel. Let's go back to the letters. And Kevin writes, I heard on CNN that Louisville only has one polling place open with all the precincts consolidating due to coronavirus. 602,000 people and one polling place, a Republican's dream. Then,
Joe, if I could, that's actually a really important point that we need to keep our eye on for the November election is the how many polling places have been closed and how the virus is being used as an excuse to really limit people's access to polling places. And when you combine that with the president's position against mail-in voting, you start to see where even more potential manipulation of the November election could occur.
Absolutely. How do you get around that? In other words, you know what's happening. They come down to one polling place, and it's outrageous. It's hateful. It's a continuation of Trump's strategy, which is to decrease the franchise, do anything you can to make sure people can't vote. How do you stop that? That's the question.
You know, at the local level, Alan, and I'd be interested in Libby's position on this, but, you know, people need to start to raise hell with their elected officials and their election boards. There are probably people, you know, in election boards that most voters don't know who they are, but it's time to be sending them a really clear message that we're not going to tolerate this closure and manipulation. It is something you can do at the local level, though. That is where you can start to make change.
Well, maybe we could go to Sienna because she's the lawyer. I doubt if you go and knock on their door, and if anybody does, it'll be something. But there is the law. There are courts.
This is true. I remember in the 2008 election, I volunteered down in Georgia. What we do as attorneys on that day is we are all at one phone bank, and we make ourselves available to anyone who feels like they're being suppressed in any way. Or is anyone denying you? We go down there, and we bring in the laws. In Georgia, at least, we brought over, and we made arguments to the board, right? Not the Board of Election, but the representative at that time, whoever was there at the election polling place, to let them vote, or we would try to fix it on that day. So that's one of the tangible ways that, as attorneys, we get involved on voter day itself, is that we're there at a phone bank ready to go when someone has any issues.
Could you make them open up more polling places?
I mean, it would happen just like it happened in Louisville last night, is you would file an emergency injunction if necessary. And so that's how prepared we were if something happened. You can reach out to a judge and make an emergency motion. So
yeah, they were banging on the doors.
Exactly. And so that's what would have to happen in that situation, unfortunately. But as Libby mentioned earlier, what we really hope for is that the board of elections getting everything together prior to the election. But on the day of the election, I think that's when a lot of legal warriors, I like to call them, will be available to make sure that everybody's getting their access to vote and fair vote.
You know, this is all very anecdotal of what I'm about to say, but it just seems, you know, we talk about this every day, and I was confused as to what was open, what wasn't open, where things were available yesterday. And it just for primary here in New York State. And I don't know, how do we do better in over the next couple of months of and realizing that there's going to be forces against this, but that you do a better job of explaining to people of how they can get their vote in and how they can get it counted, because it shouldn't be, but it does seem like it's very, very confusing.
Yeah, Joe. Well, if I could jump in on that, this shows the importance of grassroots organizations. I mean, all the way down to almost the block level, to make sure that they're pushing out the most up to date, correct information. And I'll go back to something that was said a little bit earlier. You know, Kentucky showed 1.1 million people voting in a primary. Think about what the number is going to be in November. And any government, any local government or state government that isn't upstaffing and preparing for a very, very agitated electorate, they're crazy.
Well, the problem is it's accidentally on purpose. We know why they're doing
yeah,
that.
That's true.
We know that this isn't just they're crazy or they know what they're doing. They're sitting in a room. They got eye shades on. They're sitting around a table and they're saying, how can we cut down the vote? And they're doing it.
Sienna, you were going to say?
This is.
I'm sorry, Libby.
No.
Go to Sienna and then we'll go to Libby.
Oh, Libby can go ahead.
Okay, Libby, you first and then we'll go to Sienna.
Okay, this is all about voter suppression, and we've known that for a long time, and that's, you know, key to the GOP strategy, the Republican strategy. I think on a local level, what people can do is, at least in New York, and we don't have the problems here as much as New York, but we need to figure out how the commissioners, the local commissioners of the boards of elections are appointed. In New York, they're appointed, you know, one from one party, one from the other. So Albany County, it's the Albany County Democratic Committee that appointed our Democratic commissioner. And the Republicans did theirs. And so that's the way it is in New York. And I'm sure there's something similar throughout the rest of the country. So from a grassroots perspective, it's time for people to rise up. And if it means going to their boards of elections, doing the sit-ins, doing the demonstrations outside to demand equity, to demand a rollback of what the Supreme Court said a few years ago that, oh, well, the Voting Rights Act is all settled and we don't have to enforce it anymore. That's what it's going to take. I mean, what happened in Louisville is disgusting. You know, 616,000 people, one polling place. That is a total voter suppression, and it was done on purpose. And so this is a time when, from a grassroots perspective, people need to rise up against what these boards of elections are doing on purpose to suppress the vote.
Sienna?
I was just going to say briefly that this reminds me of, you know, what happened with Stacey Abrams down in Georgia.
Right.
And what ended up happening is she filed a lawsuit afterwards, but that's beside the point, right? She still didn't win, and here we are, you know, months later, she's still trying to fix the voting issues in Georgia. So, you know, Libby's on point. We need to figure out what happens, what needs to happen before the election, because although we can litigate after the election, we all know that's not as effective, and that's not going to help with long-term change.
Well, and in the Stacey Abrams race, if I remember this correctly, the guy that she was running against, who became the governor of Georgia, was the guy who was running the elections.
Exactly.
Yep. That's right. He was the head of the state board.
The state board. You know, not that that stinks at all.
I have a question again for Sienna.
Yes.
You work for a terrific law firm, one of the best in the state. We know that. You know, how much pro bono can we expect from the major law firms, whether it's Paul Weiss in New York or, you know, or here, because it seems to me that preemptive lawsuits are what are needed here.
I mean, unless there's a conflict of interest, what I can say is over the last few weeks, I have been monitoring personally, you know, people's stance on individual firms and what we're doing as a legal community in terms of protecting people's rights and racial injustice. And everyone has come out uniformly that they are against inequality. All the law firms and the legal community stands with justice. And so I think this is a good time to, you know, call on these on individuals in the legal community to help present pro bono if these issues come up during voting rights, because voting rights is a race issue. Voting rights is an inequality issue. Voting rights is an injustice issue. So I think there's room for that. That's what I'm saying. Even in the larger law firms, our firm is committed to unity and justice. And I think all the other firms have come out in that way over the last few weeks. So I'm going to be really curious to see, unless there's a conflict issue, I believe that there's going to be a lot of litigation and a lot of people pushing for justice if voting rights is going to become a big issue in our country.
It's top of the hour. We have to take a break. We will do so. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Bob Griffin, and Libby Post. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. First News with Ray Graff. Thank you. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable panel. A ton of letters. I mean, I don't know what they weigh, but there's a lot of them. So let's get started. We go to John, who says, is there a way to know a month ahead of time how many and where polls will be? I don't know that we know that, do we? I mean,
well,
meaning?
Yes. I mean,
yeah.
Okay, my question is, yeah. I understand what we should know, but I'm saying with it's let's say there is a fall wave of coronavirus in New York, that and if things change, how do we know that, and how is that this goes back to what Bob was saying earlier about this grassroots effort to make sure that we know this stuff. But go ahead, Libby.
In New York, if there's a second wave that's going to be bad, the governor would do an executive order and saying everything would be done by mail. You know, but the polling places that are in place now are the ones that are going to be in New York State. I can almost guarantee that unless there's an executive order, but people will be able to do early voting. And you go to your local boards of elections to figure out where that is, because that's different than your election day polling place. You'll be able to do absentee, and you'll be able to vote on the day of the election. Now, whether or not in other states they add polling places, that's something to, you know, based on the grassroots activity, the pressure that's put on the boards of elections to then increase the polling places. And you find that out from the board of elections and your local elected officials.
Sid writes and says, has willful ignorance ever been discussed by the panel? Willful ignorance seems to be playing a major role in the attitude being shown by those who opt to ignore the reality and facts of COVID-19. The same may be said for the cult followers of Trump.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. I mean, the problem is, and I've said it on the air, I'm willing to stand by it, this guy is responsible for tens of thousands of deaths. And when you take that along with, because he doesn't wear a mask and because he tells people it's a joke and that it never happened and it's going to be over, and gives false confidence, so he's killing people. It's a terrible, terrible thing. Unfortunately, he can't be indicted.
Bob?
Yeah, and I haven't used the term willful ignorance. I mean, I've used the term corrupt. I've used many other terms.
Well, there are other terms that we can't use on the radio, Bob. But go ahead.
I know Mike's hovering over that button right now. and I think actually willful ignorance is giving people too much credit. We're talking about people who either ran for or received compensation to do these jobs, and they should do it correctly. So I don't think it's willful. I think it's, in many respects, is very malicious.
Sienna?
I agree. I think it's become a political stance, whether or not to wear a mask in some of these states. And that's unfortunate because it's really a public health issue. So I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know that that's very, and I think the problem is, like everyone is saying, it's because of, you know, our leadership, our federal leadership. It should not be a political stance.
Russ writes to us and says, bravo, Dr. Fauci. Oh, what a lucky man I was. Happened to be watching the hearing yesterday when Representative McKinley of West Virginia rubbed Dr. Fauci the wrong way, and the good doctor put him in his place by saying, okay, so we're going to play that game. Bravo, says Russ. Then we go to Aline, who says, good morning from Tulum, Mexico. Do you think that the rising numbers of COVID-19 cases will influence older voters in the red states so that they do not turn out for Trump? Good question. Alan?
Well, no. I think there's really no evidence that people will not vote either absentee or online because of COVID. I mean, certainly the Shartocks got their absentee ballots, and we're old now, I hate to say it, and mailed them in the same day we got them. I think the motivation that most people have who want to vote is still pretty, especially with Trump as the president, pretty secure.
If I could jump in for a sec, Joe, I do think, though, that it will be used as an excuse by whomever loses, but I think Alan is absolutely spot on, and thank you for listening to us in Mexico too. I think that's just super cool too. I didn't want to miss that point.
John writes to us and says, just noting a curious coincidence, one panelist mentioned that the U.S. has about 5% of the world's population, but nearly 25% of the world's COVID-19 infections. Those are exactly the same numbers regarding incarceration. The U.S. has 5% of the globe's population, but nearly 25% of the world's prisoners. Non sequiturs, admittedly, but interesting nonetheless.
Hmm. Yeah, the only thing I temper is that I don't believe the numbers coming out of China, Russia, India. I actually think they're much higher.
Marion says, what if the post office goes under for lack of funding before the election? McConnell and Trump will not support a post office bailout. Why is everyone assuming mail-in ballots, even absentee ballots, is an option in November? Question mark.
I think the post office is so important to most people who stand by their mailboxes and wait for the mail every day, even if it's garbage that you get, that I don't think these guys have the guts to do it. I just don't think they will. You know, it's the kind of thing we hear all the time from our writers and others. I just don't think they have the moxie to do it. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, the other thing is, if you want to put another nail in the economy's coffin, shut down the U.S. Postal Service.
Sure.
I mean, who are they kidding? Really?
Let's go to this letter from Alan, who says it's not enough that Fauci calls it like he sees it. He has to state unequivocally that the president is wrong, and what he says is dangerous. At this point, if he doesn't, he's a collaborator.
Well, he didn't this morning on NPR, I can tell you that much. He was asked a direct question, and he basically said, don't get me into trouble. He was asked a direct question about Trump and what he's been saying. And it got a chuckle, it was, you know, I'd rather have him there than kicked out, to be honest with you. And I think there is some cost to doing that.
So, if I could jump in, Joe.
Okay. Sienna first.
Go ahead.
Oh, that wasn't me. That was Libby.
Libby. Okay. I'm sorry, Libby.
Yeah. I think he's stuck between a rock and a hard place. I think that this man is truly dedicated to the public health and wants to be able to protect people and with the best information possible. And he's stuck in this vortex of having to deal with the idiot in chief who doesn't want facts, just wants his own biases confirmed by science. And that's not going to happen. And so, you know, Fauci's been around long enough dealing with a lot of different presidents, GOP and Democrat, to know how to play the game, but to also do the messaging that needs to be done to get the word out to people. And, you know, they'll do everything that they can. I mean, Franklin Graham came out the other day attacking Fauci and said, science isn't truth, God is. Well, okay. Then let's...
I didn't hear that. Science... Right under our bed. Say that again.
Science isn't truth, God is.
Yeah. Well, shouldn't we all ask ourselves the following diagnostic question in terms of this business of Fauci? Are we better off that he's been here, or would we have been better off if he wasn't? In my opinion, there is no question that we are better off because he's here and he has a tremendous amount of guts.
And you know, Alan, at the same time, we have so much distrust in government. You have to admire somebody like Fauci who has, you know, think about the sacrifices that he's made, both to reputation, but also to his own finances. You know, if he was in the private sector, what he would be getting paid and his compensation package versus what he gets working at CDC is so substantively different. So you can't ignore the sacrifice. I'm going to toss a slight twist at everybody, though. I don't think that the career bureaucrats, which I was one, you have to separate the issue of political and policy. And I don't think it's right for the career staff to be opining into the political. I really don't, because the commitment should be to the country, and your oath of office is to the Constitution. And that's your political overseers are the ones that are supposed to be passing the creating the policy, and you're carrying it out. So I think it was unfair to even put Fauci in that position.
Speaking of unfair, Bob, what was your comment about competence?
Oh yeah, nothing appears like. Oh my God, Joe, I just. a conspiracy, quite like incompetence.
A conspiracy.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Right. Well, that ticked Mary off, who said, please don't call our town clerks incompetent. We have two people in our small town who are responsible for responding to the huge number of absentee ballot requests while observing pandemic protocols. They do not deserve your disdain, which I don't think you were.
I wasn't saying disdain to them, but I will tell you that I think that your town needs to reexamine what the priorities are. And I think one of the basic roles of your town is to make sure that you fund your election systems to preserve the democratic republic that we have. So it may not be your incompetence that I'm talking about, but there is incompetence somewhere because you're not staffed correctly to do the job you need to do.
Bob, I want to parse what you said before about Fauci, because I just and whether or not career bureaucrats should speak. He's more than a career bureaucrat. He's in charge of our pandemic efforts and our health efforts. So therefore, I think he has the responsibility as a professional to speak. What? He's going to sit there and watch people die and say, okay, Mr. President, I won't do it. You can be sure every time Fauci gets on the air or speaks, you got a near coronary in the White House.
Mm.
Yeah, but at the same time, though, I think he has done that and continues to do that. But I also think that in his role, the policy direction should be coming from the president. That's the way the system is supposed to work, and that's why elections matter.
This president right now, when people are dying by the tens of thousands, I don't think so. I think Fauci has an absolute responsibility to do what he's doing, and so does everybody else who sits in a crucial place right now. And you know what? The man is 79 years old. I don't think he worries about, you know, his career or how much money he should be making right now. I just think he's wonderful.
What happened to Dr. Birx? I mean, we've been joking
oh,
about,
yeah,
Fauci, but she really is. I mean, I have not seen that woman in months.
Well, they discontinued the
well, the briefings.
The briefings, which is where we saw her.
But Fauci has made various
because
appearances.
He's a good person.
Yeah.
I'm not saying she's a bad person, but I certainly don't think she ever took the chances or risks that Fauci took.
And he was subpoenaed as well. Yeah,
well, that helps. Yeah. If you're subpoenaed, that'll get you out of your closet, won't it?
Well, speaking about subpoenas, I know we're not going to have time probably, but Bill Barr, the question is, will the House of Representatives subpoena the man? And then the question then becomes, if they do, will he A, not show up and say, the president has told me not to go? We've certainly seen that before, right?
Well, this whole story is just fascinating. You have a federal prosecutor and another Justice Department official planning to tell Congress today that Attorney General William Barr and his top deputies issued inappropriate orders amid investigations and trials based on political considerations and a desire to cater to President Trump. Aaron Zielinski, an assistant U.S. attorney in Maryland, formally detailed to Robert Mueller's investigation, will tell the House Judiciary Committee that prosecutors involved in the criminal trial of Trump's friend Roger Stone experienced, quote, heavy pressure from the highest levels of the Department of Justice to cut Stone a break by requesting a lighter sentence, according to Zielinski's prepared remarks. The expectation he intends to testify was that Stone should be treated differently and more leniently because of his relationship with the president. And yes, meanwhile, Gerald Nadler has promised to issue a subpoena for William Barr and for testimony early next month.
Yeah, Joe, and the other part of that, I know the Stone piece is getting a lot of attention, but the second part of that testimony, which I think is also really important for us to understand, is that Barr is also being accused of launching full-scale investigations into areas of the business community that he doesn't like the cannabis industry. And if you look at it, these are really, really expensive antitrust reviews involving millions of pages that the businesses need to produce of documentation. Barr ordered.
That's not my mother-in-law. Go ahead.
Okay, I was going to ask you.
No,
you had to go.
No, it's somebody else.
And they also, ordered investigation into the automakers in California after Trump tweeted about the California trying to protect the clean air. I mean, it is not just the Stone situation. It is the gross misuse of the Department of Justice and their resources.
Anybody else on that?
It's the biggest criminal enterprise we've had at the federal level in a really long time, and it makes Watergate look like child's play.
Yeah.
Well,
just so simple.
Sienna?
I'm always interested, Joe, in our listeners and how wonderful and kind they are. So here's a letter. Bet you won't read this letter. I have asked on a number of occasions what Dr. Alan Chartok is going to do for a living after our beloved president gets reelected. Maybe he can get a hot dog cart or a paper route somewhere. He will have no subject matter to speak about because President Trump will be lame duck. Good luck in your job search. Thank you. Do it. Nice guy.
What were we talking about? Sienna, what were your anything on what we were talking about prior?
Yeah, I was just saying that as the four career prosecutors pointed out, this is what happened with Stone was just very unusual, right? Because, you know, the sentencing guidelines are guidelines on what kind of penalty a convicted criminal defendant should receive. And under the Trump administration, under the Sessions memo, actually, the Trump administration's policy is that these guidelines should always be followed, They push it unless in extreme circumstances. And so in this case, for them not to be followed, these guidelines, and for him to only receive a 40-month sentence, it was very unusual. Also, when we see judges are lenient towards a defendant, usually that happens when they're very cooperative with the government. They don't cause any issues with the court. They're helping the court to be more efficient. They're helping, they're assisting the prosecutors. But that's not the case in the Stone. In the Stone case, he wasn't cooperative. He wasn't working with the prosecutors. And so the reasons for the leniency aren't there. So for us, for me at least, those are two things that kind of two red flags. One, it's not in accordance with the Trump policy regarding using the sentencing guidelines. And second, it's not what usually happens when someone is working against the system, so to speak, in the justice system. It's usually lenient sentences are usually a reward for working with the prosecution.
And here's a question for you, Sienna, from a listener, Sharon, who says, we need an organization like the Innocence Project to train lawyers across the country and provide master forms for legal briefs and emergency motions in advance for all states. Possible?
Very possible. Very possible. I think the legal bar, we're very energized right now to get out there and help individuals that have been charged with crimes unfairly, I would say. And I think this is the time for us to make sure that every state has innocent projects, similar organization to do those things.
And
go ahead, Joe, I don't know if you saw the breaking news, but apparently the federal appeals court has ordered the trial judge to dismiss the criminal case against Michael Flynn. So you're starting to really see Barr's corruption it playing out real time. I mean, there is no justice. This guy admitted to the crimes that he committed, and because of Barr's manipulation and Trump's pressure, we have a criminal who is now walking free.
Go ahead, Sienna.
I'm still reacting. It's just disheartening to hear, you know, our Department of Justice has always been, you know, it's supposed to be impartial as it can be. And to, you know, see these blatant political moves in the justice, the system of justice, it's just disheartening for an attorney. Because this is what we tell our clients every day, you know, we're going to go to court, we're going to fight, and they're going to make a fair and impartial judgment. And when you see things like this happening, it's just very hard to see, especially as an attorney.
Put another way, why do you think McConnell spends all his time getting federal judges appointed? It's the number one thing he is proud of, obviously. It really, you're right, Sienna, it really just knocks the hell out of our faith in the system.
U.S. Appeals Court ordered the federal judge overseeing the Justice Department's case against former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn to dismiss the prosecution on Wednesday. The decision is a major victory for Flynn, whose legal team has argued for months that the government unfairly targeted him for political reasons and that the FBI tried to entrap him into pleading guilty. The Justice Department abruptly moved to drop its case against Flynn last month, arguing that it did not have sufficient evidence to prove he was guilty, even though Flynn pleaded guilty not once, but three times, we should note. That story is breaking, as Bob mentioned, and we'll have more on it, I'm sure. We have about a minute, so let me just do some quick letters before we go to a break. And we have a couple on absentee ballots. I live in Rensselaer County. When I got my presidential primary absentee ballot, I noticed the outside read official ballot for presidential primary with the original date of April 28th. On the inside, it read official ballot for the general election with the same wrong date. Will these mistakes invalidate these absentee ballots? I also wonder if these mistakes existed in other counties, just in case. I voted in person to be sure my vote would count. That ballot was correct. Libby, you know anything about that?
Well, I do know that the Rensselaer County Board of Elections has its challenges. And, the ballot, if they had sent the ballot, I'm being nice, if they had sent the ballot back and it was for this presidential election primary that happened yesterday, because there weren't any other, well, it's Oakland where they live, but it would have counted. You know, John McDonald's district is Troy, Rensselaer, North Greenbush. So if they live there, then they would have had that as the second ballot in their packet as well. It would have been okay, but the boards of elections really need to just get their act together. It's really something.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll do our last call and finish up our conversation for this morning. Panel at WAMC.org if you'd like in. We'll be right back. So Christmas trees are getting the Guinness? How does that work, Bob?
It's breaking my heart, Joe. I was just thinking that. I've never wanted to be a willow tree before, but I really do right now.
What the hell? I didn't know this stuff went out of date that quick. For God's sakes.
It's going crazy, Joe.
I had trouble leaving the last time I left Ireland, but I'm willing to go back. All right.
Sacrifice.
Yes, that's exactly. All right. We have just about 15 minutes left, and I want to get to a couple of other items. Well, we spent a lot of time, of course, focusing on the John Bolton book, which was officially released yesterday. And now the next big book that the Trump administration and the Trump Donald Trump is trying to block is by the president's niece. The immediate headline is that the book refers to her uncle as the world's most dangerous man. The President Trump's brother on Tuesday petitioned a New York court to block the publication of the book by Mary Trump that describes the president as the world's most dangerous man. Pre-sales of the book slated for publication on July 28th have soared to the top of the bestseller list on the basis of a description from publisher Simon & Schuster that it will reveal decades of family secrets, including a nightmare of traumas that explain the psychology of the man who is now president. President Trump told the Axios News Service earlier this week that Mary Trump is, quote, not allowed to write the book because she signed a non-disclosure agreement in 2001. You know, there's nothing like a family non-disclosure agreement.
It
just brings you closer together during the holidays when you all sit around the table and figure out the NDA. That's lovely. So she signed a non-disclosure agreement in 2001 that settled her suit against him and his siblings over her inheritance from her grandfather, Fred Trump Sr., the president's father. And we go to the races.
Do you think that the Trump family sends their attorneys to get together before the family get-togethers? I mean,
the pre-dinner meeting.
the pre-dinner agreements. Yeah, you know, a couple thoughts. I'll start. You know, this sort of Maury Povich literature. It's completely unseemly, but it's really, really interesting. But my question is, how many more books do we need, or how much more proof do we need to know that that Trump is a bad person? You know, there's so much information out there. My question starts to become not so much about her right to publish. It's I'm still trying to figure out in my mind why the 30% continues to support this guy.
Because he's racist and they're racist, and that's what they like. I mean, that's why the 30% continues to support this guy. It's always been about race, and it will continue to be about race.
You're right, Libby. You are absolutely right. That's what it's about.
Now, conventional wisdom would say, Alan, that you let the book come out, you don't make a big fuss over it. A couple of people will buy it. There'll be a day or two of headlines, and then it'll go away. The president has never given in to that conventional wisdom. He's fought all of the books that have come out that are negative against him. Most recently, the Bolton book, and now the Mary Trump book. So, what does he gain in that of just getting more interest and selling more books for a family member that he obviously disagrees with?
Well, right you are. But, you know, Mario Cuomo used to say on our program and say that every mistruth needs to be answered. Now, in this case, there are no mistruths. It's all right. Nevertheless, his philosophy is you got to fight them every time they open their mouths. And you got to say, see, look what they're doing to me. They're hurting me. And you people who know that, and you better be with me on this. So I think that's his philosophy. Other than another possibility, Bob may want to talk to this, is the concept of the shiny bright object. You know, anything better than a coronavirus, which is killing people by the tens of thousands, and an economy which is in the absolute tank, better we should be talking about family problems.
Yeah, Alan, I think you're onto something. I also think that that Trump plays the victim card better than almost anybody. I mean, if you really think about it, this is the guy that has bankrupted so many different industries. He's screwed over so many workers, but he's viewed by
and
many
gotten away with it.
Gotten away with it.
That's the worst part of it.
You know, and getting away with it, I think, is also part of the strategy, is that that Trump continues to send a clear message that anybody who messes with him, even if they're correct, are going to have a bruising fight. And it has a chilling effect on a lot of people who aren't willing to go to the mattress, if I could use a mob term for somebody who I think is appropriate.
And, you know, Sienna, that's so interesting, because there are those people, and occasionally I'm one of them, who thinks that the law is used by rich people to punish their enemies, as opposed to the honest guy who say, well, I could sue him for saying that, but I don't have the money, and I don't have $50,000 to hire a lawyer and all the rest of it. How does that work?
I mean, it's all about how much money you have, right? We know that in our justice system, that you can sue someone, you can file injunctions, you can keep filing motions. I mean, if we're instructed as attorneys to keep litigation going and it's not nefarious or it's not a misuse of the court's time, they have the right to file their motions. They have the right to file anything they can to prove that they're right or their due process. And so what always happens is the more money you have, the more time you have to research these issues, the more time you have to litigate these issues. And so money speaks in the court of the law, unfortunately. But what I was also going to say regarding this book is, although it may not, the information in the book may not be shocking, there may be some good things that we learn from the book, because I was seeing that she was the one that she claimed she was responsible for the leak of Donald Trump's financial information to the New York Times. And so I just wonder how much more information does she have and what else is in this book. So that's why I'm really curious about the Mary Trump book.
They have kept the contents closely guarded and under wraps. But not to say, you know, they obviously want to sell books. Julia Prosser, who is a spokeswoman for Simon & Schuster, the publisher, also a friend, I would add, to me. But she is quoted, as she says, and Sam, I'm interested in this, the courts take a dim view of prior restraint, and this attempt to block publication will meet the same fate as those that have gone before. I assume that she's correct on that.
That is correct. I mean, this becomes a free speech issue, right? I mean, I know she has the NDA that she's fighting against, but it becomes a free speech issue. And those cases tend not to be successful in the court.
We have some letters here. We have about 8 minutes, so I'll try to get to as many of those as
I... You know everything, Joe, so I'm going to ask you a question. Simon & Schuster?
Yes.
That's Carly Simon, right? It was her dad who was Simon of Simon & Schuster?
I did not know that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
Leah,
I thought so. Yeah. And so maybe she has something in mind. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
They're also the publishers of the John Bolton book, I would add. I think that is also important to know. But
no,
go
it's
ahead.
All about money. Yeah, really, yeah, there's no question about it. I just thought I'd take this obscure fact that means absolutely nothing and mention it except to say that maybe she knew what she was doing when she said you're so vain.
I did.
Yes. Well, that's a song about Trump right there. That's the theme song for his life.
Right. But can you imagine how dysfunctional family has to be, that there has to be a non-disclosure agreement signed? I mean, that's just so bizarre to me.
You don't have any in your family?
No. No.
You know, the thing I didn't understand... Richard Leo Simon was an American book publisher, Columbia University graduate, co-founded Simon & Schuster, the father of famed singer-songwriter Carly Simon. There you go. Okay. Where was I? Oh, I was going to letters, right? Is that where I was headed? And we go. Thank you, Libby. We go to Sally, who says, "I'm in tears about our future. I pray we have a new administration come January. But how long will it take to undo all the evil that has been done if the courts are so pliable?" Great question. You want to take that, Sienna?
We were just talking about this amongst the attorneys because of what happened recently with the proclamation and everything that he's issued in regards to immigration. We're like, when will Biden have time to rescind all of these proclamations? What I think is going to happen is there are going to be a lot of executive orders coming out of the hopeful new administration. And then just like in Trump's administration, we're going to see some lawsuits come up. And what you're going to see is what I hope the new administration does is that they use the same or similar language to what Trump did. And they use the acts and the power given to, especially in immigration aspect, given to the president to make decisions on the entry of aliens, which would be detrimental to the interests of the U.S., which were upheld by the Supreme Court. So in this case, what I think the best thing for the new administration to do is go back to the Supreme Court rulings that occurred over the last 3 years and use that as a roadmap and use those, you know, to rescind and also do new proclamations and executive orders. So I think that's what's going to happen is you're going to see a new administration using those Supreme Court rulings to help them.
Yeah, and Joe, if I could jump in on that, I know for a fact that there are multiple different work groups right now that are putting together the first day, first 100 days, first 1,000 days of work that needs to get done. And I would anticipate a sweeping repudiation of most, if not all, of Trump's executive orders relatively quickly into a Biden administration. But there are people right now who are laying out whole roadmaps, not only for the president, but within the executive branch of every department.
Sue writes to us and says, "I think it's important while you're busy criticizing the boards of elections, in particular here in New York, you consider how the legislature and governor threw us into a situation where we had to process thousands of absentee ballot applications, mail them out, receive them back, all in the middle of a pandemic. I and my colleagues, both Democrats and Republicans, worked 6 weeks straight, including weekends, to pull this off. Add in the struggle to find poll workers willing to work during a pandemic, which is next to impossible. Poll sites can't be opened if we don't have enough people to work. Perhaps you would encourage your listeners to sign up with their local boards of election to become poll workers. We struggle in the best of times to find people." A point from Sue.
And that's a really good point, Joe. But I mean, it goes back to something I said earlier, and I think this is really important, is that we have historically underfunded things like our election boards in support of elections because we've taken them for granted. And my criticism is as much for the policymakers that are over the election boards as it is for the people who are struggling to try to pull together elections with almost no resources. But we have to really start to think differently about some of our priorities and where our money is going and what is truly important.
Anne writes to us and says, another example of what I call the dumbing down of America, the president telling a group of young people in Arizona last night that he doesn't know what COVID-19 means. It was the 19 in COVID, apparently. And he, the letter writer says, so he can continue to call it the Kung flu. Is this willful ignorance? Then...
No, it's racism.
That's the name. Carolyn says, just because states are reopening does not mean the pandemic is over. It means only that now there's room in the ER for you. We'll end there. We are out of time. My thanks to everybody for being a part of the conversation. Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you to Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Robert Griffin, and Libby Post. Thank you all very much. We'll be back right after this.